Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In April of 2010, the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig set off the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. 11 workers lost their lives, and for almost 3 months, more than 130 million gallons of crude oil gushed into the Gulf of Mexico. The oil spill devastated coastal ecosystems and dealt a major blow to the Gulf Coast economy and tourism. An untold number of marine mammals, fish, birds, and turtles lost their lives. You probably remember the photos of animals covered in oil. According to federal officials, in the aftermath of the massive spill, 25,000 fishermen and women and seafood industry workers lost their jobs. On today's Your Call, we are looking back at the Deepwater Horizon explosion and its impacts on the environment, wildlife, and Gulf Coast communities. And then later in the show, we'll talk about the collapse of U.S. crude oil prices and the future of the fossil fuel industry. Today, we're joined by Antonia Yuhas, an award-winning investigative journalist whose work has appeared in many publications, including Rolling Stone and Harper's Magazine. Antonia Yuhas is the author of 3 books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Hi, Antonia. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's so great to hear your voice and to be back on with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to hear your voice. Before we start off, Antonia, how are you and your loved ones doing?
Doing well. Thank you. Thank you so much for asking. We're in Boulder, Colorado, and it's a good place to be, knock on wood at the moment, for COVID-19. So yeah, thank you for asking.
Good. Well, we're glad to hear that. Well, Antonia, it's so hard to believe that it's been 10 years since this major oil spill. I mean, you followed the story so closely. We had you on many times. You even wrote a book about it. Can you take us back to that day and remind us how it all began?
Sure. So April 20th, 2010, on a BP rig called the Deepwater Horizon. BP is preparing to move off of an offshore drilling well to prepare it to start producing oil. And the well is called the Macondo oil well, which BP is leasing from the federal government. And at some point during the evening, the well experiences a blowout. And what that means is that natural gas and oil escape uncontrollably from the well, shoot up the pipe that connects the rig, tethers the rig to the well, and the natural gas comes first. It starts winding its way through the rig. The first thing that people identify is the smell of the natural gas. The natural gas kicks off a series of explosions. The oil follows. The explosions ultimately destroy the rig, kill 11 men, as you said, on the rig, and essentially cause the pipe connecting the rig to the oil well below to break in a series of places across the pipe, releasing a 3-month-long oil spill. And actually, you cited 130 million gallons. It's 200 million gallons of oil that was released over 3 months' time, pouring through the ocean, onto shores, onto wildlife, onto people, and also kicking off just a, if it wasn't so horribly tragic and devastating and deadly, what would be humorous series of attempts by BP and the entire oil industry, which had guaranteed all of the companies that they knew actually how to address a much worse offshore drilling disaster than this one, a series of attempts at trying to cap the well that failed and failed and failed and failed. And in fact, they didn't actually succeed in successfully capping the well for 180 days. They also applied an enormous amount, unprecedented amounts of a chemical dispersant, which really succeeded in just making the oil in the water more toxic and dispersing the oil across a much wider amount of the Gulf. And so that's the secondary harm to the ecosystems and the people of the Gulf, was the chemical dispersant that was then applied. And, you know, that's that's the basics of what happened and what began on April 20th. I think, you know, most of us are very clear that this was, you know, very far from a one-day event, and continues to have impacts to this day, and also was an event that was very predictable and predicted. So it wasn't just a fluke of an accident that occurred on this one day either, but was rather a systemic, an outcome of a systemic failure within the industry and within the government regulatory system.
And we should mention, Antonia, I remember interviewing you about the long piece you wrote in Harper's about the trip that you set out from Gulfport, Mississippi. It was a 3-week mission aboard the U.S. Navy research vessel Atlantis. And so you have very close experience with this oil rig explosion.
Well, you know, that was just an incredibly an incredible opportunity that I had because, as you mentioned, I had written, I'd been reporting for many outlets on the Gulf oil spill, and I wrote a book, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. And actually, I'll just say really quickly here before I get to the Harper's Magazine piece, a lot of people have asked me why I didn't include the name BP in the title of my book. And the reason why it doesn't say the BP Gulf oil spill is because I wanted to make very clear that this wasn't a failure of one company. This was a failure of the entire industry in the Gulf of Mexico and the regulatory system. So that's why I called it the devastating impact of the Gulf oil spill. But so this was this incredible opportunity in 2014 that I had because I wrote the book. And for the book, I had interviewed Dr. Samantha Joy, who is just an incredible expert at all oil and natural gas systems in the Gulf of Mexico and their impact on benthic, the most the smallest organisms that live at the bottom of the ocean. And she was the person who first successfully tracked oil that was floating through the Gulf of Mexico in these plumes of oil, so these sort of clouds of oil and dispersant that were being carried through the Gulf of Mexico from the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. And she, because I already knew her, she gave me this opportunity to be the lone journalist who was able to spend 3 weeks on the scientific research mission that she was leading, and to ride with her in the Alvin submarine, which is the only submersible, essentially works like a submarine, that is owned by the Navy but operated by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, which is the only one available for research. And we traveled in the sub a mile below the surface of the ocean in the Gulf of Mexico and got closer than anyone else other than BP had gotten to the site of the disaster so that she and her team could take samples of oil, samples of the soil to see what life was like or not like at the bottom of the ocean 4 years on. And what she found and confirmed, and I, you know, saw with my own eyes, was that there is a blanket of oil that has settled on the bottom of the ocean floor, and she estimates that there's 30 million gallons of oil that remain in the Gulf ecosystem, 15 million of which is on the bottom of the ocean floor, where it continues to this day to interact with marine species. And what that means isn't just harm to those very tiny microorganism species, benthic species, but you know the way the Gulf ecosystem works is like most ecosystems is that those tiny species then feed critical species such as phytoplankton, and then other marine species feed on the phytoplankton, and then larger fish feed on those species, and then humans feed on the fish, and so the impacts continue to make their way through the chain of life that derives from the very bottom of the ocean. And I heard Dr. Joy speak. There's been in the last week or so a number of really excellent press conferences of experts, of impacted community members, of advocates, of former government officials, giving press conferences about the disaster 10 years later. And Dr. Joy is definitely still mapping, you know, those continued impacts on the ecosystem of the Gulf of Mexico.
Can you talk about, since you brought that up, Antonia, what we know about how the oil that is in the deep waters is affecting wildlife? National Geographic just ran a piece about some recent research that's not yet published in a peer-reviewed journal, and it revealed that only 20% of pregnancies among the dolphins in Louisiana's heavily oiled Barataria Bay are successful, compared with 83% in unoiled regions. And that number remains unchanged from 2015 findings. Once scientists said that higher rates of reproductive failure, lung disease, heart issues, impaired stress response, and death in bottlenose dolphins. And these symptoms mirror health issues showing up among cleanup workers. So what do we know today about, let's first talk about the wildlife, and then we'll talk about how it's affecting human health.
So it's Barataria Bay in Louisiana. And so my guess is that National Geographic story is citing the National Wildlife Fund, which has been regularly putting out, and thank goodness they have, updates on the impacts on different wildlife and marine areas in the Gulf of Mexico. And they just released a report called let me just find the correct title, 10 Species 10 Years Later, looking at Gulf Restoration 10 Years After Deepwater Horizon. And that study about the bottlenose dolphins, it's even more worrisome than that. Like, they found that the Deepwater Horizon disaster was behind the most significant, largest, and longest lasting recorded dolphin die-off in the Gulf of Mexico history. And that stillbirths as you say, are still happening, and the ability to reproduce essentially continues to be harmed. They've measured a 20% loss in Kemperley turtles. They've monitored loss in a whole host of different bird species, among whales in the Gulf of Mexico that continue on. And I can go on and on there, but also in oysters. And so one of the issues is sort of where has the oil gone and what's happened to it. It's still being found, by the way, in wildlife. So they're still finding that oil in birds, in eggs, in species. But the oil also centers on the bottom. Collects on the bottom, and one. A particularly hard hit area has been Gulf oysters. So Gulf seafood is a key economic engine of the Gulf of Mexico and employs many people across the Gulf. And the oysters have yet to recover. And that's been devastating because they feed on the bottom. And that's been devastating for fisher folk in the Gulf of Mexico. So if we shift from, you know, species that continue to exhibit harm to humans, wildlife species to humans. One of the more telling press conferences I heard was hosted by the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy. And they had Daniel Lee, who's the executive director of Boat People SOS, speak. And both Boat People SOS represents fisher folk, Vietnamese fisher folk across the Gulf. They're based in Mississippi. And he said that because oysters in particular hadn't recovered, at least 30%, he said, of Vietnamese fisher folk left the industry entirely since BP Deepwater Horizon, saying that it's no longer a viable profession, is what he said. And many of these are non-English speakers, people who have been fisher folk for generations, now having to try to find employment elsewhere. And I've heard that reported throughout the Gulf. It depends on what sea life, seafood species you're talking about, the impact on the sector, because some have bounced back. And there's also been a tremendous amount of, so there was enormous organizing in the Gulf to ensure that monies from the historic, and it was historic, $20 billion federal government finding against BP made its way directly to the Gulf for restoration and recovery. And $4.5 billion has, and that's money in what's called the Restore Act. And there have been very good projects led at the local level funded through that money to work on restoration and recovery. And for that reason, there are sort of there were islands that were vital to the Gulf ecosystem that had literally been eaten away by oil, that were destroyed by the oil as it washed over them. And those critical habitats and places for seafood, where seafood rests and collects, there have been areas of recovery and rebuilding. So there are parts of the economy that have bounced back and parts that still haven't. It just depends on the species that you're talking about and then the how it drives a different economic engine. For people whose, you know, the enormous cost to workers who worked in the cleanup and people who live along the Gulf coasts who were impacted by aerial spraying of dispersants, by breathing in the oil and the dispersants as it washed up continually from the ocean, from the workers who were literally working, cleaning it up with their hands, with their bodies, and for a very long time weren't being given appropriate protective gear. That took a lot of fighting on the ground to get that protective gear provided to workers. What I have seen is that essentially a lot of these cases are still stuck in court. So people who took a payout from BP or a one-time payout through settlements, those monies have seemed to not be enough to recover. Some of them were as small as $5,000. But people who decided to fight in court, the way that the court system has worked is that one judge, Carl Barbier, has had all of the cases run through him, which means an enormous backlog, and that many, 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 many cases, probably in the hundreds of thousands, have yet to even be heard. And a medical benefit system that was set up where people could apply for more extensive medical benefits was a unique outcome. It was a historic to have that type of medical benefit system set up. There was a good deal of money put into it, but it's proven very difficult for people to pass through the hurdles that are required to get those benefits. So it's a mixed picture. There is money where there, you know, usually isn't money in these situations to help people. There were systems set up that usually aren't set up that were set up to help people, and people have been helped. But given the historic size of the spill, the length that it lasted, the breadth of the impacts, it has not proven to be enough to help enough people recover financially, their health, their livelihoods.
And Antonio, we should note that these communities have been living with the consequences of fossil fuel and the industry for decades. Last year, you wrote a piece for Rolling Stone about Cancer Alley, which is an 85-mile stretch along the banks of the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And this is where major oil companies, ExxonMobil, Coke, and Shell, operate about 150 fossil fuel and petrochemical facilities. And you report that 7 of the 10 census tracts with the highest cancer risk in the nation are found in this area.
Yeah, so the Gulf Coast has, you know, really been a national sacrifice zone for fossil fuels and petrochemicals. It's been an area where there's been, where I used to live close to you in San Francisco, where we on the Pacific Ocean and our friends over on the Atlantic Ocean have not nearly had to face the level of fossil fuel operations as the Gulf Coast. We had, obviously banned offshore drilling after the Santa Barbara oil spill in 1969, with still some platforms grandfathered in, and that's still happening offshore. There's nothing offshore in the Atlantic, and that is because people who live on the coasts haven't wanted drilling to take place there. Well, the Gulf Coast has not been so lucky, and so that's where an enormous amount of drilling takes place and an enormous amount of operations that then work with those fossil fuels. And the oil industry has always operated petrochemical plants in Cancer Alley. It's a particularly low-income area, predominantly people of color, and that's truly been a sacrifice zone has been Cancer Alley. And now that the fossil fuel industry is facing strong attempts to move past its product, to move past oil in particular and fossil fuels in general for energy, for transportation, the industry is trying to save itself by moving aggressively into plastics, converting oil and natural gas into the feedstocks to make plastics, and working hand in hand with consumer product companies to increase demand and consumption of plastics. And so what I was reporting on was a new wave of facilities being brought into Cancer Alley, massive facilities to process that conversion of oil and natural gas into the feedstocks for plastics, and the activism of, in particularly led by one woman, 68-year-old Sharon Levine, a former high school special education teacher who was a high school special education teacher until a petrochemical company bought her high school and sent them off to another school across the water to set up shop in their high school. And then she became an activist for the first time, leading efforts to stop that expansion.
Antonia, you mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but can you elaborate on why the Gulf of Mexico has such a high concentration of offshore oil drilling? I mean, we're looking right now at a map from ESRI, and it looks like they do a lot of really incredible, provide mapping data. And when you look at the Gulf of Mexico, it's just they've got minor structure and major structure, and there's just dots everywhere.
Yes, there is. And when I was riding actually in a boat to and from the ship, that the research vessel that we were on, which was far out in the Gulf, and I was riding carried out on boats to and from the ship, the boats have to dodge all of the platforms, old platforms that have been there for 100 years, new platforms that are just being built, and you have to, you know, sort of dodge through them because there's so many. As I said, the Gulf of Mexico has been permitted to be the place in the United States where offshore drilling takes place, and it thrives in the Gulf of Mexico. And now, in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon, unfortunately, the lessons learned have not been applied. So oil companies are moving deeper out into the Gulf. They are working in more dangerous environments. And though the Obama administration had put in place some new regulations to try and address that issue that I mentioned at the very beginning, which was how a blowout at the well was able to then make its way to the rig and lead to this massive explosion to try and lock in any blowout that might happen, which were good safety measures and did reduce the number of blowouts in the Gulf of Mexico. The Trump administration lifted those regulations. And so we are back to ground zero in terms there's no new regulations. The Congress failed to enact a single law in response to Deepwater Horizon. So the rules are the same, but now there's even less oversight, I would argue, because the Trump administration has definitely stated its intention to not regulate industry as heavily as the Obama administration did. And worse, since COVID-19, when the EPA announced in March that it would be lifting the requirements on companies to report pollution in the Gulf of Mexico, I interviewed John Amos, who's president of SkyTruth, which measures oil spills, including in the Gulf of Mexico. And he believes that based on data from last year compared to this year, that we are unaware of, because they're not reporting them, 40% of the oil spills happening in the Gulf of Mexico. So there's oil spilling from someone, from somewhere, but we don't know who. And that's just so unbelievably dangerous. Most I can tell you how many times I've even been involved in oil spills get spotted by NGOs, concerned activists, they let reporters know, and then reporters start digging, and that's the only way that we know that spills have happened. But then the company has to report it to the government, and then you start having really solid data. Well, that chain is now getting stopped, at the government line, or a company reports a spill, and then to the government, and then that data is then analyzed by experts, NGOs, and others, and then that data then becomes the basis of understanding better what problems that might be existing at outlets in the Gulf of Mexico. And in any case, that information is just simply not making it out to us. So things could be even worse, certainly are even worse than we know right now in the Gulf of Mexico.
So why don't these oil companies have to report spills?
The Trump administration, through the Environmental Protection Agency, eliminated, in the wake of COVID-19, the reporting requirements of the oil industry, among others, which is required to report pollutant releases. They're not required to now. So, say at a refinery, this is a very typical of what happens is the industry reports, this is all self-reported data. So there's no external monitoring of refineries, of oil wells, of anything. Pollutants are self-reported by industry in the United States. And now they don't have to. So what usually happens is, let's say at a refinery, refineries release all of these pollutants. They're often releasing them beyond the amount that they're legally allowed to do so. Most typically, a nonprofit that is a community-based organization that is based nearby will sue the federal government for not enforcing the regulations on the company, and then the company will pay something and then also presumably tighten its pollutants so that it doesn't release the same amount of pollutants. It's all based on this self-reported data. That self-reported data does not need to be reported right now. Mm.
Today, we're speaking with Antonia Yuhas, an award-winning investigative journalist whose work has appeared in many publications, including Harper's and The Nation. Antonia is the author of three books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Today, we are marking the 10-year anniversary of the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. 11 workers lost their lives, and for almost 3 months, more than 200 million gallons of crude oil gushed into the Gulf of Mexico. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be speaking with epidemiologist Greg Gonzalez about the current state of testing for COVID-19. According to Johns Hopkins, the U.S. has only tested 5.4 million people. Gonzalez says we need to be testing 2 million people every week before we can even begin to talk about opening businesses. So what questions do you have about testing and where we are today? I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. Today, we are speaking with Antonia Yuhas, an award-winning investigative journalist and author. She's the author of three books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Today, we're marking the 10-year anniversary of the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. 11 people lost their lives, along with millions of mammals, fish, turtles. And today we're talking about where we are today. And then we will talk about the collapse of U.S. crude oil prices and the future of the fossil fuel industry. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So today, Antonia, BP and Royal Dutch Shell are the biggest oil producers in the Gulf of Mexico.
That sounds right. I haven't checked it as recently as today, but that sounds plausible to me.
And so what has really changed with BP? You mentioned some of the regulations that Obama put in place and then Trump decided to get rid of them. What about BP today? I mean, what has changed over the last 10 years?
Nothing has changed at BP over the last 10 years. I think that BP predicted at the start of the once the oil spill began that it would end up paying out about $60 billion total in cleanup, costs, legal fees, et cetera, and it turned out to be almost exactly right to the dollar how much it was going to cost them, and they weathered those costs, and they are, you know, back to – they've been back to profitability since then – well, since then. You know, I think the oil industry as a whole failed. And I think that's the most important thing to take away from 10 years after the start of the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. There were many things about BP that made it not particularly surprising that it was BP that was the company that had this disaster, that caused this disaster directly. They had been operating very aggressively, more aggressive than some other companies, but not exclusively. You know, I'm stumbling because, you know, it's important to highlight the failures that happened at BP, and I, you know, do that a great deal in my book and my other writing. But for me, the biggest takeaway reflecting on it this at this time is that it was the entire industry that had promised that it knew how to prevent a disaster like this, but more importantly, that it knew how to handle a disaster like this. And they had literally used – so the federal government requires offshore operators to release detailed plans when they get their permits for how they're going to operate, how they will handle an oil spill, what they will do, how they will respond. And one of the things that came to light after the disaster was that the five largest oil companies operating in the Gulf of Mexico not only used the identical plan, but those plans were cut and pasted from their operating plans in the Arctic. So they had conditions on how they would help walruses in result of an oil spill in the United States Gulf of Mexico. So they had literally just cut and paste their Arctic plans. And believe me, the Arctic is a little bit different than the United States Gulf of Mexico, to the Gulf of Mexico. And that they, you know, hadn't taken into account the particularities of the Gulf. And they all had the same plan. And none of them knew what to do. They were all experimenting. They were all trying to figure it out on the fly. That's why it took so long to cap the well. And they have continued with those same operations ever since. I think there was one lasting upside of the Obama administration regulations, which is that the industry was forced to create different systems of working more clearly in concert and having things like blowout preventers accessible and nearby. And those things have happened. But overall, the sort of the nature of the industry to go deeper, to go further, I would argue to push the envelope beyond their even technological capacity to do the work that they are moving forward with is still the modus that they're operating under. And as a company, there hasn't been any sort of significant shift within BP, nor within the industry itself.
Antonia, we have a question from a listener. Alicia writes, what is Trump's justification for the rollbacks and the suspension of reporting during the COVID-19 crisis?
So what the EPA has said is that companies can't be expected to have the resources available to do this reporting because they're cutting employees. They're focusing on the health and safety of their employees. They have much fewer employees working. And so therefore it's a obligation that they shouldn't have to meet. The rule doesn't say not to do it, to be more explicit. It's to say there won't be they won't be faulted for not doing the reporting. So some companies are still doing reporting, and then lots of companies are not.
All right. Thank you for the question, Alicia. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Thank you for this reporting. I do have a question for your guest. It's clear that government, and this is almost any level, from the federal down to the municipal governments, have really failed people in trying to address this issue and the issue of global warming and climate change, and they've really done the bidding of corporations. And I'm wondering, I can see this even at the local level where I live, it's delusional thinking on the part of my city government. And in California now, we're finding out that Newsom, under Newsom's watch, more fracking permits have been allowed, and there's more permits being provided for drilling. I'm not sure what it's going to take. I mean, we know that we don't have that much time left, if we do, to try and make dramatic changes, and I don't see this happening. So I'm wondering what your guest has to say about where this is going.
Well, I think that brings us to the current situation within oil markets, which is an important part of that discussion of where is it going, which is this historic collapse in the price of oil. And the historic collapse in the price of oil is a result of demand collapsing because of COVID-19 and people staying home, not driving, industries not operating, et cetera. But what it truly reflects, that the reason why the collapse has been so severe is because the oil industry has been overproducing for some time. So they've been producing too much oil offshore, from fracking in particular in the United States, all over the world, producing a product in surplus, in a glut, that much of the world has been trying very aggressively to get off of. So there's this looming, what the industry is described as the peak of oil demand that we're going to hit very soon, if we haven't already hit it now, the peak of oil demand, from which point on demand will always be falling, that there is a decided disinterest in their product, but they've continued to produce more and more and more and more. And one reason for that is actually quite simple, even looking before COVID-19, which is if you're a nation or a company that is dependent on selling oil to make money, and the price is falling, which it has been for some time now, you have to produce more of it to make the same amount of money. So companies produce and produce and produce, countries produce and produce and produce, and there was this massive glut. And that overproduction had also led many U.S. companies, in particular fracking companies, were already $200 billion in debt before COVID-19, because they were overproducing a product that they couldn't get a good price for, and they were just being supported, are being supported by the banking sector trading in their debt. So you had an industry that was in overproduction, producing a product that people didn't want, and in debt. And then COVID-19 hits, and then demand craters further, but production continues. So production has continued on, and now there's nowhere to put it, and now nobody wants it. And that's why if you're in California and you look out to the bay, you'll see tankers stacked up all along from Northern California down to Southern California, tankers storing oil offshore. Companies who want to store oil in pipelines, companies who want to store oil in tanks, everywhere, just this massive buildup of oil. And what we're starting to see is a competition, two very divergent views on what should be the response. Is it, as the caller says, to go further, go more aggressive on addressing the need to keep fossil fuels in the ground to protect the climate, to protect communities that live near fossil fuels and their operations, to protect public health, and to push governments, even those progressive governments like government in California, to really take that into heart now and to use this as an opportunity to move much further along than they were, or to double down on the industry, which is, of course, what the Trump administration is proposing, to prop up the oil industry in the same way that other industries are receiving bailouts. And that's, you know, sort of the moment that we're at right now, is which direction will we go? And it's an astounding moment where oil companies themselves are actually calling for keeping fossil fuels in the ground because they know, some of them know, that if production continues in the way it is, they will completely bottom out their ability to make any sort of money ever, or at least in the near future, off of this product. So you've got, you know, people who would never have used the phrase "keep it in the ground" using that phrase now, and this moment of which direction will we go?
Today we're speaking with Antonia Juhas, the author of three books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Well, now is a good time to bring in our next guest. Alana Cohen is an organizer with the Fossil Fuel Divestment Campaign at Harvard University. Hi, Alana. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. You and a couple of fellow activists wrote an opinion piece in The Guardian arguing that it's time to let the fossil fuel industry die. You write that in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic and a climate emergency, we have a unique financial imperative to push for the systemic change necessary to protect our planet and our communities. Lay out the argument that you put out in The Guardian with your fellow activists.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we know that for the well-being of our planet and our community, particularly for our most marginalized communities and for young people who are going to be disproportionately burdened by the effects of the climate crisis, the fossil fuel industry simply has to die. And with COVID-19 exacerbating the same kinds of inequalities that our fossil fuel dependent system has generated for decades now, it's actually even more clear than ever at this moment that we have to make a radical change in the kinds of energy and economic infrastructure that we're investing in if we want an environmentally sustainable and fundamentally a more equitable and socially just system that can really serve the well-being of all of our communities, and particularly the well-being of those communities who are being disproportionately hit by the COVID crisis and the climate crisis.
Let's talk about some of the major changes that are happening. Last week, Harvard was in the news because university president Larry Bacow said that the university would move its $41 billion endowment to carbon neutral investments by 2050. The student group Divest Harvard said that this is insufficient. In a statement, they wrote, "By evading divestment, Harvard is once again standing with fossil fuel companies and against its students' futures." Tell us about this decision and what you are calling Harvard to do.
Yeah, I mean, it is a good thing that Harvard has recognized that it can't keep pretending its endowment is an apolitical tool and that fundamentally it has a role to play in the climate crisis. But at the end of the day, as we said in the statement, I mean, a commitment to a net zero endowment by 2050 is radically insufficient for any institution that claims to care about young people's futures. Because if we wait until 2050 to decarbonize, I mean, that is simply too late. We just can't afford it. And more than that, we already know that the fossil fuel industry is not a partner in the fight against climate change or the fight for climate justice. Fossil fuel companies have been sowing disinformation about the reality of the climate crisis for decades. You can just look at Exxon New for proof of that. Right now, they're taking advantage of our vulnerability in a public health crisis to secure regulatory relief, lobby for bailouts, push through pipelines, and even work with states to criminalize anti-fossil fuel protests and demonstrations. This is an industry that spends under the millions of dollars every year on lobbying against climate policy that works perniciously to evade any kind of accountability for the outsized role it has played in the climate crisis and in degrading our communities. So ultimately, there is no way to engage with an industry whose core model of business is at the heart of the climate crisis and at the heart of climate injustice. What we need to do instead, and divestment is really only a baseline for this, but it's a fundamental baseline, is move our money into environmentally sustainable and socially just industries, into the kinds of green, well-paying jobs that people deserve, particularly right now when so many people are going to be in search of new employment after this pandemic.
Fossil fuel divestment has been one of the most important developments in the fight against climate change, and you're one of the organizers with Fossil Fuel Divest Harvard. Can you tell us about some of the victories for fossil fuel divestment and the campaigns that have been happening across the country?
Yeah, I mean, over $14 trillion worth of holdings at this point worldwide has been committed to fossil fuel divestment. So that is really a momentous victory. And institutions from the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund to the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation to most recently University of California, Brown University, Georgetown University, and Oxford University have committed to fossil fuel divestment. Meanwhile, we're seeing major financial actors making statements about the need to push for more sustainable and decarbonized investment strategy moving forward. We've seen changes in the insurance company. We see movements like Stop the Money Pipeline growing, which is trying to cut off funding for fossil fuel projects from Wall Street. And all of this is really just an outgrowth of like a youth-led movement for fossil fuel divestment and fundamentally for a different kind of reinvestment in the future that young people deserve. So definitely there have been some absolutely momentous victories in this movement so far. And I think we can see with the youth climate strikes that momentum around climate is only growing. And I have a lot of hope that as we see, again, COVID playing into the same inequalities and injustices that, you know, climate campaigns are trying to tackle, there will only be a greater public recognition of the need for systemic change moving forward.
Ilana Cohen is organizer with Fossil Fuel Divestment at Harvard University, the campaign there. Antonia, you have been covering this industry for some time now. Can you talk about the power of these young voices and the young people who are leading the charge?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the divest movements, as you both discussed, have really shifted the ground fundamentally on how we think about the oil industry, who is responsible for its continuation, who props it up, where does the money come from, thinking about all of ourselves as more than just consumers of oil products such as gasoline, but people who are have a mechanism for addressing the entire sustainability or lack thereof of the industry through our various roles, including as people who are residents of cities that invest in the industry, at universities, our places where we worship, et cetera. And I think that's really changed the game, particularly with the finance sector that's really starting to see the necessity of divestment from this industry as something that is necessary for not only its bottom line, which it increasingly is, but also its public profile. And also, I think it's important to look at the Youth Sunrise movement as well, which I don't think most of us would even know what the Green New Deal is if it wasn't for the Sunrise movement, which conducted or continues to protests and organizing and sit-ins and teach-ins and all sorts of activism and learning on the Green New Deal. And those are just two examples. Obviously, the climate strike movement has been momentous. And I think a lot of the power of these movements is young people showing those of us who aren't so young anymore the face of the not only current, but long-term impacts of the of decisions not to act on climate. And I think that has an enormous power that has reverberated throughout decision-making for sure.
And Ilana, final thoughts to you. I mean, when you look at and you discuss the changes that you want to see with your fellow activists, talk about what's at the top of your list. We only have a couple minutes left, but we'd love to have you back to, you know, have a longer conversation about this.
Oh my gosh, so many. I mean, first of all, I think holding the institutions we're closest to accountable is a universal project. And, you know, as university students, I think it resonates deeply with us to want to work towards a future where we really feel like our educators are meaningfully investing in our own potential moving forward. So definitely, like, you know, expanding the divestment movement is not a project that's limited to college campuses, but it should expand across college campuses. And it also extends to the organizations we're a part of as employees and the organizations we're a part of in our communities, to our faith groups, to our governments, our pension funds. And again, divestment is only the first half of this project. Really what we need are people working towards developing broad and strategies for robust reinvestment in a green and equitable economy. And that means looking at investment in a fundamentally different way, where we're really valuing people sometimes and putting them before profit and thinking about how we can support community-owned local business.
And Antonia, we have a quick question for you before we end. Henry says, is deep water drilling still profitable now that oil prices have collapsed?
Not in the immediate term. It's too expensive with prices at where they are at this moment. But that production for a lot of these operations is built in. So it's very hard to turn production off once it's on, especially at offshore sites. So a lot of the companies are continuing to produce that oil, then store it somewhere with the hope and expectation that it will be worth more money later on.
Antonia Juhas is an award-winning investigative journalist and author. She's the author of three books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia, thank you so much for your work. It was great to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be with you.
You too. Ilana Cohen is an organizer with the Fossil Fuel Divestment Campaign at Harvard University. Ilana, we would love to have you back with some of your fellow organizers to talk about tangible changes that you all would like to see. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to join with my organizers in the future.
Great. Thank you so much. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with epidemiologist Greg Gonzalez about the current status of testing for COVID-19. According to Johns Hopkins, the U.S. has tested 5.4 million people. Gonzalez says we need to test 2 million people a week before we can even start to talk about opening businesses. So what questions do you have about testing, and where are we today? That is tomorrow. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Damian Miner and Kevin Vance, who are keeping things running at the studio. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.